I'm Daniel Vitalis of DanielVitalis.com, and you're listening to the Rewild Yourself podcast, a show dedicated to transcending human domestication, activating our invincible genetic health, and uncovering our true potential. In each episode, we explore the many aspects of the rewilding lifestyle for better health, fitness, and a more rich and fulfilling life. Rewild yourself. Engage your biology. Rewild Yourself is brought to you by SirThrival.com. SirThrival is a leading nutritional supplement and metafoods company that supplies essential formulas and ingredients for the rewilding lifestyle. Go to SirThrival.com to find a line of products that promote vigorous health, adaptation, and recovery, and help to unlock our epigenetic potential. SirThrival. Why just survive when you can thrive? You are about to hear from the amazing Sarah Buckley. This was a really fun interview for me. You know, I had been doing several interviews on the topic of death, and while that was very powerful, it was also, you know, a little macabre. And to get a little, Sarah was kind of like a bright moment in that for me, where we talked about birth and all the amazing processes that go on there. Her expertise is in understanding the hormonal aspect of the birth process. And that might sound initially like, wow, that's kind of dry. But not when somebody understands the impact of hormones the way somebody into shamanism might understand the impact of entheogenic drugs. So let me say that another way. Sarah really talks about the experience, not just talks about, she exudes the emotional states that come along with the hormone cocktail in a woman's body and in a baby's body during the birthing process. So this is really fun information, really powerful information, really changes the way we look at how we bring people into the world. You know, we've had in the past the conversation here on the show with Elena Tinetti about the birth trauma experience and how we can sort of recover and recuperate from those traumatic experiences that most of us had when we came into the world. Sarah's work really focuses on what a really ideal kind of birth situation could look like and how we can optimize that. And again, I think this is information that all of us need to hear in the rewilding community, because the rewilding thing is about a couple of different things, isn't it? It's about us recovering from domestication, but then it's also about this next generation and how we can optimize their experience so that they can be a healthier expression of our species on the planet. Anyway, I think Sarah's work is really, really crucial for us to understand how we can make sure that those who are now coming into the world get to have the best experience that they could. Sarah Buckley is a GP family physician, author of the best-selling book Gentle Birth, Gentle Mothering, and currently a full-time writer and mother to her four homeborn children. Sarah's work critiques pregnancy, birth, and parenting from the widest possible perspectives, including the scientific, anthropological, psychological, and experiential. She's been sharing her unique blend of science and wisdom with parents and birth professionals internationally since 2005. She lives with her family on the semi-rural outskirts of Brisbane, Australia. You know, Sarah, first I want to say welcome to the show, and second I want to say cool bio. I like that you say blend of science and wisdom. I think that's a really interesting perspective to say it that way. So anyway, welcome, and let's talk about that for a second.
Yeah, thanks, Daniel. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'm actually at home at the moment, so you might hear that semi-rural sound effect in the back. You might even hear kookaburras if you're lucky. So yeah, well, for me, I have a scientific background. Obviously, I'm trained in medicine, and science has a certain value in our culture. I would say overvalue, perhaps. And I think often it's not blended with wisdom. We take the science at face value. We think that science is all there is. But one of the things I've especially learned as a mother is that my intuition and my instincts and a whole lot of non-scientific things are actually more valuable in my mothering than the scientific aspects. And I think it's really important as parents, you know, to value both of those things. If we just go for the science, if we just did science-based parenting, we'd be a little bit floundering. And not only that, but we'd be at the mercy of what science says right now. There's a whole lot of things science says right now that are going to not be true, you know, in a few
years'
time. I was told at medical school the half-life of medical science was 10 years, and it's probably 5 years by now. So, you know, I think it's really important as parents to to look at the science, but take it with a pinch of salt or a pinch of intuition, if you like.
I agree so much, and I like that you chose the word wisdom as the sort of parallel to science, because I think so many people in the and I know the listeners here are probably more on this are on the same page with us, but I think a lot of people think that knowledge is wisdom and science is wisdom, and yeah, I like that you made a distinction there, just because to me wisdom has this deep, long depth of experience that is passed on from person to person, and that's really different from science. When you said wisdom here, what did you mean by that exactly?
Well, I think I agree with you, Dan. I think it's got that that long traditional aspect to it. And I also think that wisdom also lives in the body to some extent, and science is a mental construct. And again, you know, I'm not dissing science. Science certainly has its value and it can get us to some places, but the wisdom of the body is also really important. And science can be disembodied. We can say these things scientifically that don't actually take into account the experiences in the body. And again, we're talking about female experiences, especially in reproduction and pregnancy, birth and parenting. The body is the center of every event. And so, you know, listening to the wisdom of our bodies is also really important and a great adjunct to whatever we may know scientifically. And you'll see when you're in my work and in my book, particularly, you know, I quote the science, and the science is really valuable, as I said, but I also share my own experiences and I give some more what we call body-based or wisdom-based perspectives as well.
Yeah, I really feel like the two things are so important to balance each other. I mean, I feel like, you know, it's easy to get drawn into a world of superstition without science, and it's so easy to get drawn into a mechanistic, empty world, you know, if it's just science. And so I think that, yeah, I want to agree with you there, and I want to say I'm noticing also that, you know, you've kind of called yourself a writer here and you've written a book, and so you obviously are aware when you're creating something how important beginnings are. I know as a writer that's something that for me has come really clear as well. Same if I'm making a video, it's like that how it starts is so important. How a thing begins is so important. So when that brings us to the topic of human life, I feel like it's just amazing to me how much this issue of natural childbirth has not been examined or looked at by most people, because it's literally the beginning of human life. And we claim in this culture to care so much about human life, and yet we don't think much about the beginnings. Could you walk us through a little bit of kind of how you came to write on this topic, how you came to speak on this topic and produce media on this topic? Because it's clear from watching videos of you that you're really, really passionate about this.
Yes, well, I have a family history, you could say. My father was an obstetrician. My grandfather worked with babies as a family physician. My mum's a nurse, and my husband's sister's a home birth midwife. So when it came to have babies ourselves, it was we were very much oriented towards a natural perspective, and we'd supported some friends having babies at home. And I'd also had experiences of working in hospital, catching babies there. And, you know, I noticed the difference between when there was like a less disturbed atmosphere, for example, at night time, and when there was lots going on in the day, and the, you know, the difference in the experience the woman had, the difference in the experience of birth as well. And so when I came to make my own choices, when I had my first baby, we chose to have our babies at home. And I guess that was the beginning that made all the difference for me, because it was such a great experience. And now, with my background, I could see, well, if I'd had this baby in hospital, I could tell you exactly the things that would have been different. And, you know, from now looking back at that, from what I know about the hormonal physiology, and I'm sure we'll talk about that later, you know, what I know is that I got the full dose that, you know, that Mother Nature, or evolution, if you like, plans, you know, that's Mother Nature's prescription for pregnancy, birth, and parenting, that really gives that head start, that ecstatic beginning to mothering. And, you know, that continued on through all of the births. I made similar choices with all of my births. So that beginning was really what initiated me into this area. And as you say, it's a little bit of a blind spot in our culture, I think. There's a lot of, actually, when you start to delve into it, there's a lot of trauma in our culture around birth. A lot of women have traumatic experiences in childbirth because, and we've lost that wisdom. We were talking about the wisdom of traditional cultures, is that the woman's emotional well-being and the woman's emotional experience of childbearing is really important. And, you know, we put that down the bottom of the list in modern childbearing. And, you know, modern childbearing has certainly given some benefits to mothers and babies. You know, we've got low chances of babies dying around the time of birth and extremely low chances of mothers dying, but we've lost some of the traditional wisdom around it. And again, going back to hormonal physiology, we're actually beginning to underpin some of that traditional wisdom and say, yes, when we ignore, when we don't prioritize women's emotional well-being, it actually interferes with the hormonal physiology and actually can interfere with childbirth as well.
Yeah, that's interesting because it kind of harkens back to what you had said initially about science and the sort of half-life of its knowledge. It's like, how can science validate something when it doesn't even know the substance that it was looking for, right? If the hormone is yet to be named or at least isn't known yet to be part of a process, then they can throw something out until they finally discover that thing. And it's like the idea of waiting around for science to catch up to wisdom just seems so... so drawn out and pointless. So, but I want to go back. You mentioned that you saw some differences in the hospital based on the bustle going around the environment there. Can you take us back to that a little bit and tell us what you kind of first were noticing, what you saw, what kind of differences you saw in the environment there?
So as a physician working in a hospital and training in what we call family physician or GP obstetrics, so not training to be a specialist, but training to care for healthy pregnant women as a GP. Working in a hospital, you have to catch so many babies, or if you're a midwife or whatever, you have a number that you have to get, right? So the aim is to sort of, to be there to catch the baby. And it's a little odd, really, because you don't have to be there for the rest of the labor just to catch the baby. But so that was my job. So, I'd have to do that during the daytime, and sometimes I'd be on call in the night, and I'd get up and do that at night. And what I observed was in the daytime, it was much more difficult for women to get to that point, and the atmosphere around the birth was quite different. And I remember a particular midwife who basically only worked the night shift, and she had this calm aura about her. And when I went to those births, they had like a different feeling about them. And the mother seemed to have a better time, and the baby seemed to have a better time. And again, looking at, after I finished that training, then when I supported my two friends having home births, I noticed that there was a lot more calm around there, and the mothers had a lot more freedom to do what they wanted to do. They weren't pinned down, they weren't monitored. There was a different atmosphere there, and an atmosphere that seemed to really help things to flow in a sense that wasn't available in the hospital. And that's what I wanted for my babies and for myself. And again, I can't say that I was conscious of this at the time, but now looking back, you can look at, well, what's the experience of that for the baby? Because we're beginning to understand, science is catching up with wisdom, that the baby's having their own experience of birth as well. And if we looked from the perspective of the baby, we'd say, well, the baby's having a better time then. And I think instinctively as a mother, trusting my own instinctive wisdom, that my baby would have a better time if I chose a gentle birth. And I chose home birth, and I'm not saying everybody has to choose home birth for those reasons, or that's the only way to get, sort of a gentle, undisturbed, natural, whatever you want to call it, birth, physiological birth, but that's certainly one of the ways of increasing your chances of that.
Yeah, it also seems like a really great kind of ideal to work toward, even if it's not something that everybody is going to be able to experience. It certainly seems like at least women should be aware that they have this option. I feel like a lot of women don't even know. And I'm curious, I'd love to hear, now that you have the science of the sort of this hormonal cocktail you've been talking about, and you have the wisdom, I'd love for you to walk us through an ideal natural childbirth looks like. And then I'd love to be walked through what kind of a typical hospital birth looks like, and what's going on in the body, and what's so dramatically different along the way.
Yeah, great questions, Daniel. So what happens, in labor and birth begins even way before labor and birth. So there's a whole lot of processes that lead up to labor and birth. And now, one of the touchstones of my work and the report as well, we talk about evolution, that in evolutionary terms, it's obviously critical that mother and baby survive the birth. That's the foundation. But it's also critical that mother and baby survive and thrive and go on to have more offspring who survive and thrive. So for those processes to happen, it's not only essential that mother and baby survive the birth, it's also essential that lactation, or in humans, breastfeeding, is successful. And it's also essential that the mother and baby are bonded together, that the mother is, in a brain-based sense, rewarded and motivated to give the dedicated care that every mammalian mother gives to her newborn, because every mammalian newborn is born in this immature state, and humans especially so. So the processes of labor and birth involve not just processes that optimize survival at birth, but also that optimize lactation and that optimize mother-infant attachment or maternal behaviors, if you like, that turn on the mothering behaviors within the brain of the mother. So those things begin even before labor starts. So, you know, the processes that are going to make labor birth as safe as possible and optimize breastfeeding and attachment begin, well, we could say weeks before, you know, this, like it's like the, we call it the healthy birth pathway. We're walking towards this event of labor and birth, but at the same time preparing for it. So we know from animal studies that within the brain and the breast of the, or the mammary glands of the expectant mother, that preparations are happening to optimize the processes of labor and birth. For example, receptors are getting upregulated in the mother's brain, getting increased in the mother's brain. Hormone receptors are going to make the hormones work maximally effectively in the mother's brain, the mother's mammary glands, and in the mother's uterus. So that when these hormones kick in labor and birth, the body's ready, the body's highly sensitive, and these whatever hormones are released are going to be maximally effective. So that happens in, even before labor and birth starts. And then in the processes of labor and birth, so the corollary of that to say is that the physiologic onset of labor, the natural onset, spontaneous onset, different words for the same thing, is really important to optimize all of these processes. So that's something that is a given, you know, if you're having a baby in a low technology setting at home, a natural birth, but is often interrupted in hospital with scheduled birth, with a pre-labor cesarean.
Oh, let me pause there. I just want to make sure I flush that out. So what you're saying is, like, if I have a planned cesarean and I go in for that, I may be going in before that process is complete. It may have started, or maybe it hasn't even started, but the body is at that point not sensitized to these hormones because it hasn't had the opportunity to fully complete that upregulation of those receptor sites.
Exactly, exactly. Well, we know we can't say 100% in human studies because we haven't managed to sample the receptors in the mother's brain before labor or in her mammary glands. But we know that's true in the uterus. And we also know it's true for the baby. So, you know, just as the mother has these critical processes happening before labor and birth, the baby also has, because obviously the baby's making this most enormous transition from life inside the womb. Sometimes I call it hotel de womb, if you see my the baby has everything on tap, you know, and they keep warm 24/7 and the food's delivered and the wastes are taken away, and apparently it's quite idyllic.
Yeah, sounds nice.
My children tell me. Anyway, and then the baby has to suddenly perform all those things for themselves. And not only that, there's that transition, but there's also these enormous stresses in labor and birth, so that, you know, in particular at the end of labor, the mother's uterus is contracting, and each contraction squeezes the placenta, and that deprives the baby of blood and oxygen to some extent. So the baby's got to get through this, like, almost marathon experience of being deprived of blood and oxygen, and then come out the other side and then make these enormous transitions. So you can imagine there's a lot of help for the baby, support for the baby to make that happen, because, you know, in human babies, we know that, you know, given the right conditions, that, you know, that happens just perfectly for about 95 to 99% of babies. So, you know, Mother Nature's superb design, as I sometimes call it, is there to support the baby's transition as well. So one of the major hormones that supports the baby in that are the called the catecholamine hormones, epinephrine, norepinephrine, adrenaline, noradrenaline, the fight or flight hormones. And even just like with the mother, even before labor and birth, what happens for the baby is there's an increase in the receptors for these hormones. Again, there's another hormone that stimulates that, but basically the catecholamine receptors increase in the baby's body, so that when these hormones kick in later, you know, this process of labor and birth is, we could say, an exciting or a stressful event for the baby. So the baby gets these peak levels of the catecholamines, epinephrine, norepinephrine, and even more as labor goes on, from the stress of labor, from the hypoxia, the low oxygen levels. So these things are building up, and then these receptors are there from the pre-birth preparations that are going to make those hormones maximally effective for the baby in labor, so that these hormones can protect the baby during those long, strong, close together contractions. It actually protects the blood flow and preserves the blood flow to the baby's heart and brain, the critical organs. These hormones also begin the preparation for that amazing transition to life outside the womb. So they clear the fluid from the baby's lungs. They put in, they increase surfactant, which is a lung lubricant. They open up the airways. They also start the burning of brown fat, which helps the baby to make their own heat, because, again, The baby's being ejected from Hotel de Womb, which is thermoregulated. The baby's kept nice and warm, and the baby has to make their own heat after that. They also reconfigure the baby's metabolic system. So again, in Hotel de Womb, the baby's, you know, delivered all the glucose, all the nourishment that they need, but the baby has to provide that themselves. And in human babies as well, there's this gap until the mother's milk comes in. So the catecholamine hormones and all that pre-labor preparation that the baby has reorganize the baby's metabolic system. So the baby's blood sugar is going to keep supplying the baby's heart and brain, the essential organs, until the mother's milk comes in. So, you know, again, looking at the other side of that as we go, the babies that miss this catecholamine surge and the pre-labor preparation as well, particularly the pre-labor cesarean babies. So if the baby's born by pre-labor cesarean, we know that the problems that they're likely to have are breathing problems. They don't have that preparation for breathing. Metabolic problems, they tend to have low blood sugar, hypoglycemia. They tend to be cold as well. And they also tend to be just, you know, not quite all there. They're just not alert in the brain because, as I said, this catecholamine surge preserves the blood flow to the brain. So they tend to be drowsy and not ready to start up breastfeeding. And I think the analogy that I think about with the pre-labor cesarean for the baby, it's like someone comes in the middle of the night and they strip the bed clothes off you and it's cold and it's dark and you're not ready to wake up and they shine this bright torch in your eyes because, you know, the normal processes of waking up in the morning is exactly the same. Your hormones are doing this little dance to get ready for waking up, and you know you're ready, and your diurnal rhythms are perfect at that moment, and you can wake up gently and as expected from the perspective of your body. But similar to the pre-labor cesarean, it's a hell of a shock. The baby's not expecting it.
I'm kind of hearing that it's an interesting thing you're saying here, because I think with hormones, sometimes what I've noticed is there's a tendency to have these grossly understated caricatures develop about certain hormones, and so. For instance, I think the public image of testosterone has started to change finally, but for a long time it was like just associated with, I guess, the worst qualities of masculinity in the public's eye. And now we're starting to see, oh, it's actually, you know, it does a lot of great things for both men and women. It's very important for our health. Similarly, I think, like, you know, adrenaline, norepinephrine, we hear that and we think like fight, flight, freeze, but it's actually kind of fight, flight, freeze, or be born. Eh? It's like really important for the ability to come through that unscathed.
Yes, I think what you're highlighting there, Daniel, is that we've sort of lumped stress into the bad basket. We think all stress is
right.
Bad. But stress is actually critical for human functioning. Like, we have to be able to adapt to our environment. We have to be able to keep our homeostasis. And, you know, in the wild, our stress responses were always being worked out, and that was probably a good thing for our bodies. And we have this, you know, this situation now where we think stress is bad. And it's interesting you say that because, you know, in the beginning when they discovered this about babies, that babies are born with these high levels of stress hormones, I thought, oh, that must be bad. We should be saving babies from that. We should be giving them pre-labor cesarean so they're not so stressed at birth. But what we know now is that stress is actually really critical to the baby's transition and adaptation. So, yeah, exactly, stress is good. And, you know, in the corollary, if I could take that a little bit further, you know, there's another hormone that I write extensively about. And again, it's in my hormonal physiology report, which is the hormone oxytocin. So we used to think that was in reproduction, we used to think all that did was, you know, cause arrhythmic contractions of labor. But now we know from just a ton of research, both inside and outside reproduction, that it has major beneficial effects in childbearing and outside childbearing. It's a hormone that switches on maternal behaviors. It's a hormone related to breastfeeding. It's a hormone of love that actually mediates, you know, connectedness and strong attachments between people. And, you know, that's one of the big questions, you know, that I ask in my report and in my work. Like, if we start meddling with the oxytocin system in labor and birth, what sort of long-term impacts might that have for mothers and might that have for babies? You know, what are the long-term implications of how we're really interfering with these hormonal processes of labor and birth?
Yeah, and you just can't help wondering if, looking around at the world today, that is what you're seeing, right? You're seeing children and parents who didn't get to bond in the proper way or the ideal way. I mean, I certainly have gotten more attuned to what oxytocin feels like in my own body. And I just, yeah, I just can't, I don't think that my mother and I were able to fully bond that way. And I think that has borne itself out in our struggle to have a really healthy relationship over the years. You know, I mean, I think we've done well, but I don't think that we had that great oxytocin moment together that we could have had.
Yeah, and that's what every mother and baby, you know, are designed to have through these millions of years of evolution. Michelle Odont, who's a mentor and an inspiration of mine, calls it the beginning of a great love affair, you know, because in the wild, if mothers and babies don't fall in love with each other, well, you know, then survival, the chance of survival is reduced. So it's actually critical, you know, from a survival perspective. But because in, you know, modern culture, babies can survive and mothers can, you know, survive without this biological bonding, as I call it in the report, then it's become like an optional add-on. But from a evolutionary perspective, it's actually critical. And the thing about it is it's actually not that difficult. It's not that difficult to make it, to help it to happen. And you know, from my perspective, from a hormonal physiology perspective, you know, the events around childbearing are just critical, that the mother has a full oxytocin activity during labor and birth, and that, you know, the mother and baby meet during that hour after birth when they are both, and it's totally appropriate or totally upregulated hormonal system to meet and to fall in love and to have, well, not the just the oxytocin systems, but all these other hormonal systems that I talk about. So the baby's got this catecholamine surge, so they're wide-eyed and alert to meet the mother for the first time. They've got the energy to initiate breastfeeding. The mother actually has a catecholamine surge at the end of labor. She's wide-eyed and alert, and you get these two wide-eyed, you know, mother and baby looking at each other and taking each other in. And then there's oxytocin, hormone of calm and connection, which bonds them together as well. But the other hormone that really interested me, well, oxytocin does turn on the reward centers in the brain. You know, when you have an oxytocin moment, it kind of feels good, right? But also the other hormone that interests me in this whole thing is the beta endorphins, a group of hormones. And they stimulate the reward centers as well, so that the mother and baby have these peak levels after birth. And what I think, and this is really looking at the whole picture of the hormonal physiology, and it's not, you know, it's one of these things that we say a mosaic coming into view, so I don't have all the evidence for it at the moment. But what I think happens is that in that hour after birth, the mother's reward centers get turned on in a long-term way so that she continues to find her baby rewarding. So you know, when we have that, then parenting and all those things we have to do for our children become not just a pain in the bum, but actually something really rewarding. And just looking at our baby or the sound of our baby, in fact, the sound of our baby crying can activate those reward centers. There was an MRI study done looking at mothers who'd given birth like pretty much naturally and mothers who'd given birth by pre-labor cesarean, and they put them into an MRI machine 2 to 4 weeks after giving birth, and they played the sound of their baby crying. And the mothers who'd been through this natural childbirth, the parts of their brain that lit up were those reward and motivation centers, the alertness centers, the empathy centers, and that didn't happen to the same extent for the cesarean mothers. Yeah,
wow.
So something didn't get turned on that should have got turned on, that makes mothering rewarding, makes the baby rewarding, even the baby crying rewarding. Now, I think that's a little bit of the story of our culture, really, Daniel. Like, we don't, you know, parenting is generally regarded as a bit of a drag, and, you know, like all these things you've got to do for your child that are essentially not rewarding. But if you get that that system turned on at the very beginning, then that could alter the whole thing. It's my current hypothesis.
It's
hard to prove, but lots, you know, in animal research also, they did this research where they got mother rats between, it was about 2 and 10 days postpartum, and they offered them a choice of bar pressing for cocaine or bar pressing for babies. And, well, not actually, simplistic way of putting it, but basically the rats chose the cocaine over the babies. And if they had the opportunity, they would bar press, and a little baby would come down the chute till the cage had 20 babies in it. That's how rewarding the babies were. And once they got to 20, they wouldn't have any more until you took one out, because 20 was their limit, right? That's how rewarding the babies were. They'd kept bar pressing until they got more and more babies, because that was like, that would stimulate their reward centers. And in a human sense, you know, I've used the word reward, motivation, but it's actually pleasure. Our babies, we design that our babies give us pleasure, because we have to do that. We have to have that dose of pleasure to get us to do all those, you know, really very demanding things to care for small babies and children. And in my own experience of having those those my four babies, you know, naturally in that sense. I think I got that full dose of reward, and you know, even in their teenage years, it's really helpful to have that essentially positive, rewarding, you know, interaction with your children. They are essentially a source of reward for me. Yeah.
Yeah, that's striking, because I feel like when we start having, well, I'm sure that you have this conversation with new and expectant mothers far more often than I do, but I do occasionally have it. And it depends where somebody's at, obviously, how open they are to hearing about these ideas, if they've been thinking about having a very conventional kind of medical birth. But I feel like the piece you just told would be one of the most crucial things to hear, because I think if a mother knew, oh, wait, if I do this, because so many women are just like, oh, I just don't want to hurt, or I just don't want that, I just don't want that. If it was like, if you knew that the next 18 years could be pleasurable or could be challenging based on whether or not your brain got switched on in this way, I think a lot more people would be turned on to this idea. And it also brings up for me that it's one of the great challenges of science as it is today, I guess, you know, and medicine as it is today, is so often it's on us to prove why something that we used to do should still be done, as if, like, you know what I'm saying? It's like we have to go out and prove this before they're going to open up to it. And that's just really, I guess it's so challenging, because I feel like they should be selling us why we should do it the way they want to do it, since they're offering the alternative, you know?
That's really important to consider in childbearing, Daniel, because, you know, the foundation is physiology, how our bodies are designed to work. So anything that deviates from physiology, we should need a ton of evidence that it's doing better than physiology. But, you know, some people turn around and say, we've got to prove that physiology works. I mean, that's just a totally bizarre perspective, you know.
It is, and they call what we do alternative, and I sort of recently saw that word in a new way, and I was like, oh, it's alternative, to alter what's native. Alternative. Therefore, they are alternative. We're not alternative. We want to do it the native way. They want to do it the alternative way.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm totally on the page with that. You know, I think one of the touchstones really is how our body's designed to do that. And, you know, going back, how have our bodies been designed through these millions of years of evolution? And in fact, we have six, you know, if you go back to the first placental mammal, which is, you know, how our reproductive systems have evolved, that's 63 million years ago. Mm. So that's how long, you know, human childbearing has been evolving, and it's evolved in the context of the wilderness, and that's given it, that thing had particular things hardwired into it. And we were talking initially about, you know, stress and the circumstances of birth, and that's really important to know, that that's our native, you know, setting, is to give birth in the wild, and that any mammalian female giving birth in the wild has to be hypersensitive to her situation, to the possibility of danger around. So what happens in labor and birth for modern women as well, is we have this extreme sensitivity to our environment. I mean, are there familiar people around? Is it a familiar smell? You know, am I seeing strange things? And all of those things, if they're unfamiliar, you know, the limbic system, this primitive, you know, sort of intuitive part of the brain, is, you know, going alert, you know, this is not a safe place, and turning off the hormones of labor and birth and turning on the stress response system. So really, you know, what we're talking about explains a lot of what, you know, that necessity for the woman to be in this calm and familiar, you know, as familiar as possible situation. And, you know, one of the analogies that I sometimes use is I say that the ideal situation from a hormonal perspective for labor and birth, for having a baby, is almost identical to the ideal situation for making a baby, because it's almost exactly the same hormones. We've got oxytocin, hormone of love, hormone of orgasm. We've got beta endorphins, hormone of pleasure, you know, that peak at orgasm. We've got epinephrine, norepinephrine, that actually peak at orgasm as well, and prolactin as well. So they're all hormones of making babies. And, you know, so a rule of thumb could be, if, you know, if the circumstance you're choosing to have a baby, you know, the ideal circumstance is the sort of circumstance you could successfully make a baby in.
That's incredible, and I like it because it's so easy to remember and understand. It's so easy to grasp that. Okay, so here we are. So we've been talking a little bit. Let's keep walking through this ideal birth. So we've gotten to this point where we've got the sort of the coffee shot has come through. We've got the epinephrine, the norepinephrine. We've got the oxytocin is flowing. So now we've got the sort of pleasure. We've gotten into this beta endorphin. What happens next?
So, yeah, so these hormones build up for the mother during labor. Obviously, we can't, well, we actually, the baby can be sampled. They've actually sampled, you know, sometimes they do a sample of the baby's scalp blood to check the oxygen levels. Well, they've actually sampled the baby's scalp blood and seen, yes, the baby is building up these epinephrine, norepinephrine levels as labor progresses. But the mother, we can certainly sample the mother, and we know that her oxytocin levels go up somewhat, but there's a big surge at the end of labor. We know that her beta endorphin levels go up as her stress and pain increases. It's Mother Nature's natural health. It's our own intrinsic, our own endogenous pain relief that Mother Nature gives us. And the other thing that happens as labor progresses, and this is often not really recognized in our culture, is that mother enters this altered state of consciousness. And so the beta endorphins shift her into this, like, you know, dreamy state, and in childbearing times we call it going to labor land or going to another planet. And apparently one of the Native American tribes says that the laboring mother goes out to the stars to collect the soul of her baby and bring it back.
Oh, that's so good. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so that's a natural thing that happens when the mother enters this internal state that helps her to deal with the stress and pain and also gets her really focused within her body. And, you know, in labor, the baby's moving in this quite unusual way, like because we walk upright, because we, you know, we had to change the shape of our pelvises, our babies have, we have these unique twists and turns that our babies have to navigate. It's an asymmetrical process in humans, and that's not true in other animals. And most animals have a fairly straight birth canal, and the baby just comes out basically. And, but we have these larger babies and this asymmetrical birth canal, so even the anatomy is a little more challenging for humans. So, and when the mother enters into this altered state, she gets really tuned into her body, and she'll move in some quite bizarre ways. Often she'll adopt these weird positions, but they are helping the baby to come down. She's responding to the sensation she's getting from inside, from her baby, and you know, that'll help her baby to come out as well. So this altered state of consciousness, which is associated with these really high levels of beta endorphins, it's like the best runner's high you'll ever get, right?
Yeah, I mean, I almost want to say, like, beyond, I guess runner's high, I think, is kind of takes us there, but I mean, this person's high. I mean, they're high like they took drugs high, right? I mean, we're talking about a significant altered state of consciousness. I think with the runner's high, like, I like to run, and so sometimes people talk about that, and I feel that to a degree, but it's not like I've imbibed a substance. I mean, I would hardly, I don't know, I feel like people underestimate, at least what I've seen from people who've done natural births, I feel like this is much more of an altered state than people really have anchored in, believe, and understand.
I think it's really unique because it's not just the hormones happening at birth, but as we discussed, all these preparations are happening before labor and birth. So the mother's got these maximum number of endorphins receptors in her brain and in her spinal cord. Analgesic properties and then the altered state of consciousness properties are maximal. And I agree with you, Dan. I don't think there's anything, having experienced it four times, I don't think there's anything like it. Like, you're totally in this altered state. And, you know, like, it can be ecstatic. I mean, there's pain and there's stress as well. And what I say is that these endorphins put the woman into this altered state of consciousness to help her to transcend the stress and pain of labor. It's not like it usually abolishes it. I mean, some women do have painless births, but my own experience was it put me into this totally altered state. And I'll describe what happened with my last birth. So my last birth was very, very intense. It was an hour and a half with my fourth baby, and, you know, partly because I'd had babies before, but it was. I mean, it's an intense experience. It's, you know, you could experience as painful. And, you know, I think if we're undisturbed in our labouring, we can find a way through. And it might be through using a process like hypnobirthing. It might be through using breathing. I mean, my first labour, I used yoga. I used my yoga training, my yoga breath to get through that intense part and then come down. But this one, I used oxytocin, this labor and birth. It was so sweet. So my husband was there, and what I did was with each contraction, I just looked into his eyes and I said, I love you, 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 I love you. And it was amazing. It was so ecstatic, and it totally got me through each of those contractions, and I had to have him right there. Like, he couldn't go away because I really needed him. And that's, you know, that was what got me through that particular labor. Like, it might not work for everybody, but
lucky baby.
I totally surfed, you know, surfed the contractions. My own body wisdom was to do this. That's what came up for me, and I was in this undisturbed situation where I had the ability to do that. I mean, you know, in some circumstances it would be difficult to do that, and you know, so the more, you know, space you have around you, the more opportunity you have to follow your own instincts and enter this altered state, and, you know, not be having to think about other people. You know, what can really get you out of this state is adults, you've got people around, you've got to deal with them, or they're talking to you or asking you questions. You know, you don't have access to the tools that this beta endorphins altered state can give you.
Yeah, I mean, the difference between being at home and being in a hospital, I just can't even imagine. And I do feel, and I know this is a sensitive topic, and so we have to be careful how we talk about some of this, because I think we need to honor the births that people have had, whatever they are, and the circumstances that can arise that can alter somebody's plan. But that said, very often, I think a lot of times it's just a lack of preparation and planning for why somebody isn't able to have the kind of birth experience that they want. At least I guess I'm drawing off of the people that I've known. The people that I've known who've had the kind of birth experience they wanted to at home have typically put a lot more energy into the planning phase of that. And then a lot of people I've known who've sort of kind of halfway planned it end up in circumstances where things get a little out of control for them. Have you noticed that, or does that sound like an unfair assessment?
Well, no. I mean, all you need to do is look at the research, Daniel, to know that that's true. So women who plan to have a baby at home, their chance of having a cesarean is much, much lower, under 10%, and then some studies under 5%. You know, women who plan to have their babies in hospital have a 30% chance of a cesarean, and that's even higher with a first baby. So I need to look at the studies to see that that's exactly right. And then the intermediate, you know, going to a birth center, or there's various, you know, midwifery-led unit in the UK, various ways of constructing that, but you know, they tend to have intermediate levels. I mean, some of those figures are very good, but you know, we call it model of care. So the model of care, the caregivers that you choose, is probably one of the most important determiners of your outcome in the end. So it's exactly what you say, and we just look at the statistics to show that. And certainly if you do choose an out-of-hospital birth, that in itself is going to involve a lot more preparation. You don't just walk in there and it's all set up. You have to think about who do I want there. Like, there's a lot more forethought has to go into it, so I think that's part of it. But I think that basically the model of care is really important. And, you know, in some places, there was one interesting, it was a Canadian study where they looked at the same caregivers caring for women at home, or the same group of low-risk women, while similar risk status in home or in hospital. And even in that situation with the same caregivers and a similar group of women, the women at home had lower rates of intervention. And I think about it as a physician myself. So I'd go and do home visits for my patients. I'd see them in my clinic sometimes and see them at home sometimes. And when I'm at home, when I'm going into their home, you know, I'm on their territory, and the chance of me taking liberties with their body, which, you know, it'll be like just, you know, putting a blood pressure cuff on them without, you know, really saying, "I'm going to do this," is much lower. Like, it's a different scenario. It's their territory. And I think, you know, that's
right, as opposed to you being in your shop. As opposed to you being in your shop, like, it's like you're a mechanic and you're in your shop, you're much more comfortable to start, you know, moving things around, changing things.
That's exactly it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I've never thought about that. It's so true.
Yeah, because I noticed that myself as a care provider. Yeah, yeah. So that's interesting. Yeah, so you know, I think exactly on your page, I think the model of care, the caregivers that you choose, is really one of the most basic determiners of the ultimate outcome. And you're right, sometimes things go pear-shaped, sometimes things happen in a way that's unexpected. I mean, the other thing about choosing an out-of-hospital setting is that generally, you know, in a hospital, you know, and that's the problems with the in-hospital birth centers, is that they tend to have more rules and regulations around them. So you have a little bit more freedom to make your own informed choices. And there was another interesting paper that showed that, you know, women who have their own midwives, and I think it was home birth midwives, actually have more evidence-based care. So their care providers are actually giving care that follows the science more than women giving birth with a standard obstetric model of care. So that was interesting too.
So once the baby is out, what's going on then, and how long are these hormones active in the body? What's the come down like from this high?
Yes, well, that's a really interesting question too. So it's interesting that, you know, I don't know if you've heard of this thing called the Baby Friendly Hospital Initiative. So it's an initiative put out by the World Health Organization and UNICEF. There's a credentialing. You can become a baby-friendly hospital. It's quite common in Australia, I think increasingly common in the US, but all over the world. And the reason they've designated, or they've put this program together, is to increase breastfeeding rates. And the Baby-Friendly Hospital Initiative has 10 criteria, and one of them is that mother and babies need to be together for the first hour after birth. And it's interesting that we've said that. We've noticed that this hour after birth is a sensitive period. You know, it's a period where things can happen, you know, things can get set into place that can't happen later on. And the hormonal physiology is really supporting that in a in a major way. So what happens is mother and baby, then the moment of birth, we could say that's the moment of orgasm, and we use a sexual analogy, and some women do have orgasms giving birth because of those enormous peaks of those birthing hormones, the same hormones of sexuality. So birth can be an orgasmic event. Just to read the, see the film Orgasmic Birth, and you can find out more about that. So orgasmic, you know, that peaks of labor and birth. So the baby comes out with these peaks of the adrenaline, noradrenaline, epinephrine, norepinephrine, catecholamine hormone. So the baby's in this alert, oriented, energetic, wide-eyed situation to connect with the mother. And the mother, similarly, in a following a physiologic undisturbed birth, has high levels of catecholamines and is in this perfect situation to meet the baby. But also both have these high levels of oxytocin through the process of labor and birth, have better endorphins. And also there's a surge of prolactin in those final moments. All these hormones interact with each other so that the peaks of oxytocin stimulate peaks of prolactin and also stimulate better endorphins. I mean, it's all a, you know, it's all like a cocktail. It's all an orchestra. You know, they're all playing off each other to get this perfect moment of birth. And so the catecholamine hormones, what happens is, and if you think about, again, going back to that stress hormone thing, like that, it's perfect that they're born with these high levels of stress hormones, but it's really important for the baby that these stress hormone levels come down, because these stress hormones are actually what I call metabolically expensive. So when we've got high levels of adrenaline, noradrenaline, we're churning through our metabolic fuels. We're using a lot of glucose. Our brain's really alert. Our muscles are on standby. And the baby doesn't have much metabolic fuels. We talked about exiting hotel de womb, and the baby has to make their own metabolic fuels till the mother's milk comes in. So it's really important that the baby has high levels at birth, but that levels come down. And the opposite, I haven't really talked about this, but that stress program, you could call it, the catecholamine surge, the opposite of that is the oxytocin, the parasympathetic nervous system. We call it sympathetic. It's a physiologic term for the stress system. And then we've got the parasympathetic, which is the rest and digest, the calm and connect program. And that one of the key hormones in that is oxytocin. So mother and baby after birth have these peak levels of catecholamines and this excited, we call it stress, but we could also call it excited, alert state. And then what happens naturally is the baby's born, the baby goes onto the mother's chest, and the surges of oxytocin increase. The mother's oxytocin level goes up even by a factor of 10 through the skin-to-skin contact, through the baby's pre-breastfeeding behaviors. Yeah. So the oxytocin surge turns on calm and connection, turns off the stress hormones for the mother and for the baby. And that's really important, that the mother and baby have this immediate and ongoing skin-to-skin contact to optimize the hormones. But not just that, we talked about how all those hormone receptor systems are upregulated and perfected really for the surge of hormones after the birth. And so what we think happens is that the hormone, sometimes like I say, when a mother gives birth, she graduates as a mother, and the hour after birth is a postgraduate education. All these peaks of hormones working on all of this preparation that's happened up to that moment to form this bond that will optimize survival for the mother and for the baby. It's an evolutionary necessity, yeah? If the mother and baby don't get that in evolutionary terms, or for other mammals, the mothers don't care for their young. So these things that get turned on is what I've called in the report biological bonding. It's a term I got from a man called Nils Bergman, who writes about this extensively, about skin-to-skin contact after birth. So what we think is that our after birth is critical for those processes we mentioned before, the biological bonding that turns on the mother's oxytocin system, that permanently alters her reward and motivation in relation to her baby, that turns on the baby systems as well, that turns on the oxytocin, turns off the stress hormones. And there's something also unique, and I can't explain it at the moment in terms of hormonal physiology, that when mother and baby are skin to skin and the baby begins to suckle in that first hour to hour and a half after birth, then that turns on something to do with breastfeeding and probably prolactin that gives an ongoing benefit to milk supply. And it may be prolactin receptors. It may be that the peaks of prolactin at that time upregulate or increase the prolactin receptors, which then help with the ongoing abundant milk supply. But we know, as I said, from the Baby Friendly Hospital Initiative, that what happens in that hour after birth, the skin-to-skin contact, optimizes breastfeeding in a long-term sense. I don't think we know really how that works from a hormonal physiology perspective, but we suspect it's to do with oxytocin and prolactin. And one thing I didn't mention is when you do put the baby skin to skin on the mother at that time, the baby can actually find the breast and self-attach. Have you heard of that, Daniel?
Please go on about it. Please go on about
it. So if you think about what happens with other mammals, every mammal comes out and knows how to get onto the mother to self-attach. The mother's pig, as I say, is not in there stuffing the baby onto the to the teat. The baby knows how to find the teat and self-attach. And that's true for human newborns as well. We didn't actually know this when I went through medical school. We knew the baby had all these like reflexes. We could stimulate, the baby can actually step. If you stimulate the soles of the feet, the baby can suckle. But we didn't actually know what they were for. But now we know that when you put the newborn baby skin to skin, or actually a baby of up to about 6 weeks onto the naked mother's belly, the baby will actually crawl up using these stepping movements. On the way, they'll step on the mother's uterus, which will stimulate the uterus.
Oh,
rub the mother's uterus, right? And the baby will find the nipple by smell. The nipple smells a bit like amniotic fluid. They'll locate the nipple.
They'll
see the nipple, you know. They'll actually, first thing they do is actually to massage the nipple with the hand. And one study measured the mother's oxytocin
levels. The baby does that?
Yeah, in relation to the baby's hand massage. You know the way kittens will, you know, like they'll purr and they'll sort of do that kneading with their paws. Yeah, I don't know if you've had a cat in your lap doing that. Well, that's an instinctive behavior of human newborns. They'll actually massage the mother's nipple.
I did not know that.
And that nipple massage increases the mother's oxytocin up to 10 times, especially critically in the first hour when the mother's system is so sensitive. So they'll massage the mother's nipple, give this oxytocin surge to the mother, and then they'll snuffle around, and then they'll self-attach and get onto the nipple. And all the time, you know, the hormones are happening, the oxytocin for the mother, you know, this active state for the baby to help them to self-attach, and then the skin-to-skin contact, which is soothing all of those processes and switching on these calm and connection, reward, motivation, mothering, breastfeeding, all of those programs as well in that critical hour after birth.
Oh my God, it's like you get your finish line, you know, the first great hero quest. Like you said, you know, you've got all that, those excitement chemicals moving through you because you've got a place to get to, right? I knew a little bit of that. I didn't realize the extent to which a newborn infant was prepared to actually make its way to the breast like that. So going with your analogy, the idea of the baby not making it to the mother in that first hour for the skin-to-skin contact is almost like two lovers then after orgasm suddenly being separated, right? And not having that integration moment, right? Sudden
That's
separation.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So how much greater is the chance, let's see if I word this right, how much greater is the chance that won't happen if there have been lots of medical interventions like a cesarean? Does that significantly reduce the likelihood of the mother and baby getting contact, or is that such a big deal now that they're trying to make sure that happens more regularly?
Well, I think we've become aware of it, and skin-to-skin contact is really a bit of a buzzword in the last 5 years, I would say, and people are starting to realize the importance of it, and as you say, especially for women who've had a cesarean, because you know, when you don't have that buildup of hormones and you don't have that pre-labor preparation, then you really need as much hormonal help as possible. And we talk about this in the report as well, that, you know, we're adding more physiology. If something hasn't gone right, how can you add more physiology? And, you know, any time that we're skin-to-skin with our babies, it'll increase our oxytocin, it'll reduce our stress levels, it'll increase prolactin, it'll increase beta endorphins. So all of those things are really, really valuable for a mother that hasn't had the labor, that hasn't had the pre-labor preparation. So I think we are beginning to understand the importance of it. And even, you know, even in the last few weeks, there's been a lot of interest in maternal-assisted cesareans where the mother puts the baby on her own chest straight away after birth. Mm. So I think we are beginning to really take that into account. I think that's been a really great change that's happened in childbearing to acknowledge the importance and really try and work towards how can we get mothers and babies skin to skin as soon as possible, particularly after cesarean. And including your epidurals, we haven't talked about those, but they actually interfere with all of those hormones we've talked about. They reduce beta endorphins, they reduce oxytocin, they reduce adrenaline. So the mother doesn't get that hormonal support really for early parenting, for breastfeeding as well. And the studies that show that women with epidurals are successful in breastfeeding are generally studies that give mothers that extra hormonal help of putting the baby on the skin, on the body immediately after birth, and support for breastfeeding. So interventions can interfere with all of those hormones that we talked about, and then in addition, they can also reduce our chance of having the baby in our body. And, you know, the trouble with epidurals, for example, is some women get a fever, sometimes there's complications, sometimes forceps or vacuums needed, and all of those things, exactly as you say, increase the chance that the baby will be separated to be checked over. You know, the baby might have problems at birth, the baby, you know, might be affected by those things as well. So any intervention that reduces the chance of, you know, skin-to-skin contact after birth, you know, from all this hormonal physiology is really a major intervention. So anything that makes the baby more likely to have breathing difficulties, a fever, you know, anything that's going to separate is, you know, it could potentially have this long-term effect.
When I started the show off, I kind of started by saying beginnings are so important. And, you know, we get this opportunity to live out this, you know, if we're lucky, a full human lifespan. I know now we're really getting into the land of speculation, but if I can pull you in there with me for a second. Over the course of time, as more and more, I mean, it sounds like this research is in its really early stages still. Like, we're still just starting to get this picture together here. How much adult behavior, how much adult neurosis, how much do you think we're going to learn is affected by these things? So it's not just these chemicals don't happen to, you know, it's not like it's just what goes on in the hospital that day, right? I mean, do you think this stuff is following us throughout our lives if we didn't get that really ideal start?
Well, there's a number of ways I could answer that question, Daniel. I mean, one way is the story that you started off with, which is your relationship with your mother. So, you know, if the mothers don't get that initial biological bonding or that initial head start with attachment to their baby, then that can have an ongoing effect. And we're getting more and more studies showing that, you know, attachment systems in the child are critical to lifelong health and well-being. So if your attachment systems aren't that good, and this is attachment in a psychological sense, there's various ways of assessing attachment, and a secure, insecure, avoidant, etc. So we know that if the child's attachment and adult's attachment systems are good, then their lifelong health and well-being is benefited. So that's one sense. If the mother gets the hormones to bond with the baby, then that affects lifelong health and well-being. So another way of answering that question is to look at epigenetics, and we talk about that quite a lot in the report. So we know that what happens in pregnancy can have an epigenetic impact on the child. We know that from extensive studies. It's called the developmental origins of health and disease theory. Well, it's not a theory now. It's a really well established, and I think that we've got that really understanding in our society in general that, you know, you shouldn't drink alcohol in pregnancy because this could have these ongoing effects on your child. Yeah, it's epigenetic. It acts by changing the expression of our genes, turning genes on and off. So we know that's true in pregnancy, and we also have some very solid animal research showing that the mothering behaviors, the mothering amount of mothering, you could say, in an animal sense, that their offspring receive actually epigenetically alter their attachment systems and then alter their mothering behavior later on. I can explain that if you want to hear. It was an interesting cross-fostering study. You know, they got rats that were bred to give high levels of maternal care and rats that were bred to give low levels of maternal care, and they cross-fostered them. So the low maternal care babies that were brought up by the high maternal care mothers then went on to give their own babies high levels of maternal care, was based on their own experience, and they could actually look in the brain and see the epigenetic changes. So we know.
Let me just make sure I understood that. So you said if the rat is bred for low maternal care, but it's raised by a rat that gives high maternal care, then that baby will follow in the footsteps of the surrogate mother, you're saying, because
that's
of epigenetic
changes?
Wow.
So that's an epigenetic effect, and they can actually see it's actually to do with estrogen and oxytocin. It's an oxytocin effect.
Oh,
so we know that
that's
true. Yeah. So we know that you know, where the epigenetic changes can happen from things that happen in pregnancy and things that happen postpartum. But we haven't even begun to think that epigenetic changes could happen from perinatal, from intrapartum, from what happens around the time of birth, which is like a big blind spot, right? I mean, that's a bizarre thing to not even have that in our consciousness, because, you know, we just talked about the enormous changes that the baby makes from inside the womb to outside the womb, and those are almost certainly epigenetic changes. Things are getting turned on and off. The circulation system is changing. Everything's changing for the baby. So, you know, the baseline would be a lot of epigenetic changes happening anyway. So you'd imagine that anything that changed that, you know, that changed the baby's hormonal situation, etc., would have ongoing epigenetic changes. And we know that that's true in animal studies. We know animals born by cesareans have different brain chemicals. We know that animals exposed to high doses of synthetic oxytocin in the first 24 hours have changes in sexual and parenting behaviors and their oxytocin system, oxytocin receptor changes. We know all of that's true in animals, and we know the pre and the post ones. So, you know, why wouldn't there be epigenetic changes in relation to exposures in labor and birth?
And we're generations deep into this. I mean, we are children born to mothers who were born to mothers who were born to mothers, and generations of these kind of diabolically twisted birth scenarios. I mean, it's just where do we go from here? I guess, man.
I mean, I agree. And epigenetics, you know, epigenetics has a transgenerational impact. I mean, epigenetic changes can be transmitted through generations. Yeah.
You are really fun to talk to, and we've been on for an hour now, and I feel like we just are scratching the surface, but it's been, your passion comes through so much. Tell us about this report. Tell us about, you know, where to get your book. Tell us about where people find you and what you're offering out there in the world for people who want to know more. I mean, I think after hearing this, it's like, okay, this is the biological imperative. We got to change how this works. You know, how do people get involved with you?
Yeah, thanks, Daniel. So my website's sarahbuckley.com, and there's a lot of material on my website as well for parents and professionals. I also have a membership website called gentlenaturalbirth.com, which has got all sorts of goodies. It's got, I'm just finishing off a program for parents, 3 trimesters of pregnancy, 3 10-week programs with a lot of great information, a lot of science, a lot of wisdom.
Tell us about that. Is that for people then who are planning to have a baby, who are pregnant, or who are the members there?
At the moment, we've got 3 trimesters, so early pregnancy, mid-pregnancy, late pregnancy, a lot of really good information for people that are pregnant. Further down the line, we will do some preconception stuff, but we haven't got to that as yet. And there's also a whole section of that for birth professionals or anyone who wants to know more. So a lot of the information I'm talking about, I've got lots of webinars and lots of other material and resources on that website, gentlenaturalbirth.com.
And cool. So that's a member site then for people who are pregnant or getting pregnant, and that's a member site also for people who work in the field as doulas or midwives and things like that?
Yeah, who want more information, birth professionals, yeah. So there's that. And I also want to point you towards the report I've been mentioning, which is called Hormonal Physiology of Childbearing. If you go to the website childbirthconnection.org, you'll find that on the homepage. So it's a big read. It has a lot of detail in it. It's more than 200 pages. We've got more than 1,100 scientific references. So it's a great read. But we also have an abstract and an executive summary that I'd recommend that you read. And we also have we've also extracted some of the critical information out there for parents and for professionals. There's infographics, there's fact sheet, there's a great booklet for pregnant women, really putting it into context of the sort of things that we've talked about today. So I highly recommend that, and that's all on the Childbirth Connection website.
Cool, and we will put links to that then with the show notes. Where do people go to find your book?
So my book is Gentle Birth, Gentle Mothering. You can go to my website and find it there. It's available also on all the Amazons around the world through Penguin Random House. It's published Penguin Random House. Yeah, they're just combined publishers, so yeah.
Cool. All right. So we just covered all that. I guess I want to give you the floor to just sort of close it out because I, like I said, I feel like we could go on a really long time here. There's so much. It's such a beautiful conversation, I think. When we talk about the way nature set it up, my heart's just like singing. And when we start talking about the way so many births are going in the medical world, it's like I start to lock up and close down inside. It's like, it's amazing how powerfully this makes somebody emote, I think. Where's this all headed? Where do you see it going? What kind of message do you want to leave us with? What do you want people to know?
Well, I have a very, you know, I know that things are a little disrupted hormonally at the moment for many mothers and babies, but I really believe that we can turn that around with, with the understanding of it. And it's exactly what happened with breastfeeding. You know, once we started to understand how critical breastfeeding was, once we had the science behind it, things started to turn around. And with skin-to-skin contact also. So I really believe we can, you know, begin to really support women and offer models of care, which, by the way, are cheaper than the conventional models of care, to support physiologic childbearing and to, you know, to help women to make an informed choice for what's right for them. I'm not saying everybody should have their baby at home or have physiologic childbearing. You know, it's really about making an informed choice and realizing what the consequences are and, as you say, what the long-term consequences are. So, you know, my fundamental take-home message is trust your body. You know, we've got these millions and millions of years, 63 million years of evolution is hardwired into our bodies, and our bodies are designed to work, and we can't really improve on the processes of labor and birth. We can only get out of the way. Yeah, we can only provide the most undisturbed, the most supportive atmosphere possible. So, you know, really look into and choose and make an informed decision about, you know, where you want to have your baby and who you want to have your baby with. And, you know, think about those longer term things as well.
Yeah, I'm so glad we had you on the show. this is really fantastic. And I feel like what you're bringing is such an ideal resource for so many of the people who are going to hear this. So thank you so much. I'd love to have you back on the show sometime.
Yeah, my pleasure, Daniel. There's lots to talk about, isn't there?
There is so much.
Really appreciate your work too. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to the show. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe to the show on iTunes. And if you would, leave a rating and a review. That's really going to help us get this message out to more people. And it's going to help us know what you really like and what you don't like, and help us really tailor this show to your needs and to what you want to hear. Please stay connected with me at danielvitalis.com and sign up for my newsletter and my magazine, Rewild Yourself. And you can subscribe to both of those right there on danielvitalis.com. Got lots of really great shows lined up, and I'm going to keep bringing you more great information. And until then, keep rewilding yourself.